You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'm Ken Lieberthal, director of the John L. Thornton China Center at Brookings. Delighted to have you here today. This is the second, for those of you who were here 2 days ago, this is the second program focusing on China's economy. The previous program looked at the 12 five-year plan, what it entails, prospects for implementation. This program focuses more on a retrospective look of what's happened in the Hu Jintao, Wang Jiabao era on the economy, and what has changed and what has not, as with a particular focus broadly on issues related to marketization. We've got four really outstanding presenters, so I want to take only a moment to introduce all four, and then each will come up and give a presentation, and then we'll have time for Q&A from the podium afterwards. The first presenter will be Professor Barry Naughton, who is an economist and professor at the University of California, San Diego. He, along with Nick Lardy, one of our other presenters, are really, to my mind, the two leading academic macroeconomists who focus on China. Barry focuses in his writing mostly on four interrelated areas: market transition, industry and technology, foreign trade, in China's political economy. He's the author of Growing Out of the Plan, which anyone who follows China's economy is familiar with, and then more recently a major book that I think is used very widely as a text, The Chinese Economy, Transitions and Growth. And he is the So Kwun Lok Professor at UCSD. Second speaker is Professor Fu Bing Su, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at Vassar College. He received his Ph.D. in political science from University of Chicago and has taught at Brown University before joining Vassar campus. Most of his work revolves around, in one way or another, China's land policies, which is, as you know, is really one of the most sensitive issues and important issues in China today. The third speaker will be Nigel Chalk. Mr. Chalk is senior advisor and part of the management team of the IMF's Asia and Pacific Department. He's currently the mission chief for China and the Hong Kong SAR. And he just came in from Hong Kong. I'm delighted he's here for this. He holds a Ph.D. from the University of California at Los Angeles. We are heavy on California talent here. Both he and Nick Lardy from the Peterson Institute across the street, who will be our fourth speaker, are going to be focusing more on the macroeconomic side of the picture. Nick Lardy, as almost everyone here I'm sure knows, is the Anthony M. Solomon Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He spent quite a period at the Brookings Institution before the Peterson Institute stole him away from us. He was at the University of Washington before then and has written numerous articles and books on a variety of aspects of China's economy, trade, finance, agricultural policy, and other things. Each speaker will speak for up to 20 minutes, and then we'll do Q&A for all four speakers at the same time afterwards. So with that, let me step out of the picture and ask Barry Naughton to come up, please. Thank you. Sorry, one other brief announcement. The slide sets that Barry Naughton, Nigel Chalk, and Fu Bing Su use will be posted on the Brookings website within a few days. So if you, as you take notes, just keep in mind you can access those slide sets probably 3 or 4 days from now. Okay.
So as the first speaker, I get the privilege of sort of choosing the angles of attack for this very big, broad, and important question. And I'd really like to do it from the standpoint primarily of ownership, state ownership in particular, and corporate governance institutions. And what I'd like to do is really just start out with a few simple assertions, and then follow from there by looking at the way that the Chinese government policymakers pursue and conceptualize the concept of market reform. Then take a look at some recent, actually really just one recent case where we see some clear regression in the reform process, and then ask why it matters and where we should go from here. So let me start out with a benchmark. The benchmark, of course, for this panel is 2002. It's the end of the Jiang Zemin Zhurongji dynasty, if you will. And I just want to emphasize that as we start out, you know, at our benchmark period, we're really looking at a couple-year period where it's very, very natural that the reform process would ebb a little bit. If we look at the situation in 2002, the country was experiencing a kind of reform fatigue, also a Zhurongji fatigue, right? Everybody was a little bit tired of this dynamic, you know, head-cracking, top-down guy who kept pushing the country forward into uncharted territory. But more generally, the costs of reform at that point were highly visible, high unemployment, cases of corruption, insider privatization. There was anxiety about what WTO membership was going to mean. And at the same time, there was a whole alternative agenda of social issues, which really had been neglected during the 1990s. Healthcare, rural taxation, the social safety net, issues of discrimination against migrants, and everything. So it's not surprising, then, that the focus of the policy agenda and the focus of rhetoric shifted away from market reform in the early 2000s and towards a different kind of set of government responsibilities. What I'm going to argue today is the thing that's really peculiar is that in the ensuing years, as the benefits of reform gradually became extremely obvious, rather than returning to a reform agenda, Chinese leadership increasingly took the achievements of reform for granted and allowed them to lapse. And the result has been an across-the-board regression, both in the ideological and theoretical commitment to reform and in the practical and specific achievements that have been made over the last 10 years. Now, let me start out by just kind of a rhetorical gesture. Let me advance a definition of reform that is admittedly rather narrow and rather strict. Right. And let me just, in this case, define market reform as a set of policy changes that remove entrenched privilege or entrenched interest groups and open a specific economic area to fair market competition. Now, that's a pretty narrow definition. You could certainly argue about it, whether it's the most appropriate definition. But the point of advancing this narrow definition is it allows me to assert something that's readily falsifiable. I'm going to assert that by this narrow definition, there have been no reforms in China since 1999. So it'll be easy for any of you to contradict me, just prove the example that shows the counterexample. In that case, I'd have to concede that I've overstated my case. Now, I must say I've sort of put aside the financial system. There are lots of complex institutional changes in the financial system where it seems to me this assertion might be more debatable, and I'm waiting to hear from my colleagues who study the financial system more intensively than I do. But I think we can start out by this relatively unambiguous and easily falsifiable statement. Now, I think this statement also has an additional advantage, which is that it reminds us what reform is and what reform does. Reform typically involves paying some kind of upfront cost, especially politically, but sometimes economically as well, and then delivers a stream of benefits which are only gradually apparent and only apparent over the long run. Now, I should start off by saying, before we sort of launch further, this is the strict definition of reform. If we step back for a minute and relax our definition, of course China over the last decade has seen literally thousands of reforms in a less strict definition. There have been enormous policy achievements, particularly in that social reform agenda that I mentioned in the previous slide. And of course there have been hundreds and thousands of changes that have made China more effectively managed, in some respects more accountable, in some respects more transparent. So I'm not for a minute trying to deny the completely evident dynamism and steady growth and improvement in Chinese institutions and development, but I am saying that a certain kind of reform agenda defined in a certain way has become almost irrelevant to the current state of the Chinese political economy. Now, one way that I want to look at this is to take one of the milestone innovations of the early years of the Hu Wen administration, and that is SASAC, the State Administration, the State Asset Supervision and Administration Commission. It's hard for us in some ways, I think, to even remember the simple fact that when SASAC was created, it was created with an extremely ambitious and important agenda of economic reform. I say it's hard for us to remember because that agenda has gradually eroded over the years. It's more and more ambitious elements of it have sort of slipped away, and we've gradually all become used to the idea that SASAC is, well, it's one of those instruments of government power, government authority, and it can achieve certain things, but you know, in terms of creating qualitative change in the way that ownership is exercised, it's really become less and less interesting. And I think we can see this by reminding ourselves what that initial agenda was. Of course, there were several strands of it, but let me just take two main parts. One, SASAC was supposed to restructure the main large state-owned central government firms. Ideally, most of these firms would become what they call 100% listed. That is to say, all of the assets of this corporation would be packaged into a modern joint stock type corporation, which might or might not be listed on the stock exchange, but would certainly have a kind of modern accountable system. Now, what that meant most importantly is this first sub-point here, eliminating the middle layer. That is to say, when SASAC was created, almost all of the firms under SASAC's direct control were actually semi-bureaucratic holding companies. They weren't corporations. They were old-style state enterprises. They had a mixture of assets, some of which were packaged into corporations, and some of those corporations were listed on the stock exchange, but others weren't. And so it was basically a mess. It was non-transparent. It was not easily manageable by normal management procedures, and it required a major political and economic effort for SASAC to sort of get on top of what the assets were, who controlled them, in a sense, where the money was in this big bureaucratic system. The second goal, and this is really striking because the head of SASAC, Li Rongrong, restated this goal literally hundreds of times. He said, I'm going to reorganize, rationalize, and consolidate these firms to under 100 by the end of 2010. I mean, he's on record as saying this so many times. And his goal in doing this was explicitly Jack Welch from General Electric. Jack Welch, who reorganized General Electric and said, every division has to be in the top three in its sector or it'll be divested. And Li Rongrong said, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to consolidate. Only the most competitive and effective and focused firms will survive, and there'll be fewer than 100 by 2010. They wanted to create boards of directors with independent outside directors and to restore a normal dividend process so that state firms would pay dividends to their state owner. And a part of this agenda also involved defining in a rational way exactly what state firms were supposed to be doing. In other words, given that China had just emerged from a decade of dramatic privatization, one of SASAC's key objectives was to say, we're going to have state firms, yes. So in that sense, the creation of SASAC inevitably resulted in a kind of slowing down of the privatization process, yes. But part of this was also to say, there's a justification for public ownership in certain sectors, natural resources, public utilities, national defense. And we'll articulate that justification. And that also means that we'll draw a line around the state sector that defines the scope of private business activity as well. Right? So you can see that this agenda, of course, Li Rongrong knew very well it couldn't be achieved right away. It's going to take time. But this was an ambitious agenda that envisioned transforming China's state sector into a modern, diversified ownership, potentially listed on the stock market type of public ownership like what we see in Western Europe. Unambiguous, right? Now, by late 2010, when Li Rongrong retired, none of these objectives had been achieved. And they had, in a sense, faded out from the policy agenda. So let's just take a look at a couple of them real quickly. Restructuring these apex companies, unachieved. More than half of the, and when I say apex, I mean the top-level firms that are directly under SASAC, but which have as subsidiaries many different companies, and including many different listed firms. More than half of the apex companies are still not corporations. They're still so-called state-owned enterprises, Guoyingxie. As of the end of 2008, I don't have more updated information, but I'm sure it hasn't changed very much since the end of 2008. Only 20, well, let's jump down one. Despite Li Rongrong saying hundreds of times that he would shrink the number of corporations to less than 100, in fact, there are 122 by the end of 2010 after Li Rongrong retired, and the goal was abandoned. So restructuring was not achieved. Only by the most loose definition, 20 firms were 100% listed, meaning that that all of their assets were incorporated into one modern corporate vehicle. Boards of directors still exist in a small minority of firms, and even more important, the whole concept of what a board of directors is has subtly shifted over this decade. So that a board of directors that was initially intended to be truly a representative of the owners with a few independent outside directors has really become a kind of strange hybrid organization that serves as an interface between the Communist Party Personnel Bureau and SASAC, on the other hand, typically staffed by retired bureaucrats who are, you know, a kind of negotiation body that links the corporation to the government bureaucracy. Quite different from the initial conception of a board of directors. Dividends were, in fact, restored, but they're restored according to something really that's more like a tax than an actual dividend decision, where these big firms either pay 5, 10, or 15% of their after-tax profits into a special Ministry of Finance defined fund. But perhaps even more striking has been the lack of progress in the effort to define a sectoral structure of state ownership. In late 2006, Li Rongrong announced a set of principles that were supposed to govern how state ownership would be distributed. Now, this set of principles was really odd. It was announced in a speech. The speech got a lot of publicity. But the set of principles had sort of four different tiers. You know, there was one industry, one set of sectors that the state should control. There were a set of sectors where the state should maintain the absolute ability to control. One of the sectors in there was coal. That seemed especially strange because there are lots of private mines in the coal industry. Nobody could make heads or tails out of this set of definitions. And the really peculiar thing is that SASAC made clear after this speech that the State Council was going to issue a proclamation embedding this set of sectoral principles into, not exactly law, but into a proclamation by the highest organ of government. And it never happened. That document either was never agreed on, or if it was agreed on, it was never published. So the result is, by last year, SASAC firms, the apex firms, are in 41 out of 99 total economic sectors. Their first-level subsidiaries in 81, and if you take two levels of subsidiaries, 87. So in other words, in some sense, we can say SASAC was organized with an objective of clarifying the lines between state sector and non-state sector, and they failed to do so. And as a result, state firms are active in almost all sectors of the economy, even though, of course, they're far from dominant in most of those sectors. So along with this ebbing of the reform agenda, we also see a big change in the kind of rhetoric that gets used at the top. And I want to direct your attention to a statement by Wen Jiabao in the early part of March 2010, because I think it's very telling. And the crucial point is what he says is, of course, we need to have the market, and we also need to have government intervention. But the way he states this, if you look at it carefully, what he says is, we have to continue with what we've already been doing in terms of markets and market reform. And the new thing that we need to add to that is a much more assertive and authoritative government direction. And I think this perfectly encapsulates the approach of the Chinese government in the last couple of years. Yes, we want market reform, but basically we've already got it, so we don't have to do anything new. Now, it's in this context that I want to just briefly talk about one little example, and that's an example where renationalization has occurred. These are in the coal mines of Shaanxi. Now, we should say right away, this is, could be a completely atypical example, because private coal mines in Shaanxi have the most abysmal safety record that you could imagine. They're death traps. And people have been, you know, literally thousands of miners have been killed. So in some sense, it's perfectly natural to see the government moving aggressively in this work safety area. But at the same time, we need to pay attention to the fact, to the details of what happened in this one particular case. First of all, this is not an area where there are fuzzy property rights. During 2005-2006, what we might think of as a last wave of privatizing reform in the Chinese economy, the province of Shaanxi sold the subsurface coal rights to private businesses, for the first time giving them a clear, legitimate ownership and management stake over a natural resource field. Of course, underlying ownership remained with the state, but clear rights were parceled out to a private sector. And billions, many billions of renminbi were invested by private firms in this particular sector. Then in 2007, 2008, a series of disasters, Beijing starts firing the top politicians from the province, two of them in a row, one of them who had already gotten fired a couple years before. That's kind of an interesting story. But under this top-down pressure, the province of Shaanxi completely reversed the policy, renationalized the mines. Elements of expropriation were present, although it wasn't just plain expropriation. Just, you know, to fill in some details in this one municipality, here's the private sector beforehand, more than a quarter of total capacity, and also a big TVE sector. After this renationalization, those two sectors together, less than 10%. Of total capacity, total output. So a really major reversal of the direction of ownership change. Now, since I just admitted that this was perhaps an atypical example, why do I in fact think it's important? I think it's very important because even though it may be atypical in a way, it also sends very, very clear signals through the Chinese political system to policymakers and decision makers at every level and every place in China. What are those signals? First of all, there's intense top-down pressure to solve problems. If you've got a mine safety problem, you better solve it or you're going to be fired. And the national government doesn't care how you do it. You have to solve it. Second, if you're going to solve it, direct state control is more effective and more reliable, not only in the sense that you can get the results, but also you can deflect blame. It's not that mine accidents stopped after the renationalization, but the firing of provincial governors certainly stopped after the renationalization. And third, direct state control and renationalization are now legitimate ways to implement planning objectives. And I think this is especially important because, as you know, if you work with China, you look around China, China is always making plans. And sometimes those plans are realistic, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're fulfilled, sometimes they're not. The benefit of the great merit of the system is that it makes plans, but it doesn't necessarily constrain actors with these plans. So you get some of the benefits, but also some of the back and forth flexibility in the actual implementation process. Here we've got a plan for mining consolidation and safety improvement that's actually being implemented in a top-down fashion. Now it's being spread to other provinces. It's a model in other sectors like cement and steel, and it signals a new approach. Let's come back to the question of time lags, and then I better wrap up with these points. If we say the benefits to economic reform are delayed and the costs experienced up front, then we should recognize two things. First, many of the benefits from 1990s reforms are still rippling through the economy. So let me show you one slide. I'll cut two down to one. This is the state industrial workforce. I think you can see two things from this. One, the decline in the state sector has ended and the state sector has stabilized. Right? Here's, you know, the end of the Jurok G era, and here's the period we're talking about. It's not shrinking anymore. But let's face it, China's economy, incredibly dynamic and expansive. So overall, industrial workforce still increasing dramatically. So when we evaluate the current situation, we recognize there's a stagnation in current policies, but also that the economy continues to benefit from some of the decisions already made in the past. The final conclusion that we make from this is the current stagnation in reform policy is also going to impose costs, but those costs will be diffuse and experienced only gradually over the next decade or maybe two. In a way, that makes me somewhat optimistic because we've got a situation where reform has, in a sense, market reform has, in a sense, been fatherless or parentless over the last 10 years. As the costs of this stagnation and reform become apparent, it might be, and I stress might, relatively easy for new leaders to reinvigorate this reform process, because I believe without such a reinvigoration, they won't be able to achieve any of their other objectives. Thank you.
It's a little bit intimidating to discuss economic topics among this star panel panelist. But I can, my excuse that land market is not fully complete yet, and in fact it's full of politics. What I'm going to discuss partly is going to confirm no reform hypothesis. I think the land market has to some degree stagnated. In fact, it's to some degree also reversed the early reform momentum. But what I want to add is I hope that my presentation will give you some sense of hope that from top it's very, because for various reasons, it's very slow. But there are tremendous local dynamism in Chinese economy. Local governments and also the individual farmers and the individual household are constantly pushing the boundary. And they are definitely making some progress. And of course, in the end, there should be interaction. So I'm asked to talk about the land market. Let me first present a few overall evaluation of land marketization in the last three decades. First of all, is that in terms of ownership, there's very little change. Of course, no change. Basically, still this kind of dual structure remained, state and collective ownership. But on the other hand, it's a land use right as a kind of the partial of the property rights has become very exciting development. The use right market has boomed, and in both farmland and also construction land. I will focus on farmland and construction land because these are two most dynamic areas. And instead of saying there's no progress, I would say reform is on the road. It's taking two steps forward and one step back, but there are constant fights among the local governments, central governments, and different actors in society. So I would say this is definitely not a planning system, but it's very complicated. I wouldn't call it sophisticated. The reason I will show you later on, it's very complicated land regulatory regime. But there are some remaining challenges. One is the efficiency issue. There's a serious misallocation as a result of this kind of a property rights kind of a system. And there are also justice issues. Not just efficiency, but also who's going to benefit from the land marketization. And I think that's one issue I will talk a lot about. It's development rights for the villagers. And finally, is that I think key player in this process is really local governments. Instead of being the fair hand or kind of an invisible hand regulating the market, they are the dark hand or black hand in this kind of land market. And so that is one issue facing this kind of marketization in the future. So in the next few minutes, I'm going to break it down into two parts. First, I will talk a little bit about farmland. Then next part, I will talk about construction land. These are two areas. Most of the data are drawn from the empirical and survey work we did in the last 10 years. And there are also some data from a statistical kind of report from the government. So that's the basis of my kind of talk. So let me first get to farmland. And in this area, in terms of ownership, again, there's no change. Collective land ownership is still maintained, and the communal allocation as a rule of allocating this kind of land is still protected. That kind of allocation is certainly good from equity perspective, because as long as you're part of the communal kind of community, you are entitled to certain plot of land. But there are certainly problems from economic perspective. It's because usually household can only get a small parcel of land, and this can be problematic for kind of economic efficiency. There's also the possibility of reallocation every 10 years or 30 years, there's uncertainty involved. So they can cause some investment kind of a problem for household. But the general direction of the central policy in the last 30 years is also clear. Even though they don't want to privatize the farmland, but they do want to address this efficiency issue. Their solution is that we will extend the tenure of the farmland. Instead of 3 years, 15 years, 30 years, 1998, in this latest kind of extension of land tenure, they basically said we'll extend the land tenure to 30 years. And in fact, later on, Wen Jiabo claims that long-term, we'll make this long-term kind of, we won't change this, readjust this land for a long time. And later on, he said, long-term means forever. So his basic sense is that we will continue to give the sense of there's no privatization, but we want to create this kind of certainty in the market, agricultural kind of production. But in terms of privatization, it's still a taboo topic. And for the central government, a big concern is stability, because farmland is still generally regarded as kind of a safety net. As long as farmers have a plot of land, they can always eat and have a decent life. And for villagers, actually, surprising. Actually, we conducted some survey, and we asked some question about farmers' attitude toward the government's farmland tenure policy. All those four questions, basically asking, do you like government policy to extend this kind of tenure, 30 years or forever? Long-term stability, is this something good? And we surveyed around 2,400 farmers in six provinces. And their question actually is, their answers are majority, 60% of them says, we don't like it, it's not good. Only 30% say, oh, it's good, we should do this, continue. So there's actually some kind of public support. It's not just the central government is concerned about this. And There's also the, that's not surprising that we ask the villagers, have you adjusted your land in the past? And there's also interesting pattern here is that before 1998, this kind of land readjustment, complete or partial reallocation is more kind of more frequent. But after 1998, after the central government committed, we are going to extend this for a long time, it's indeed kind of slowing down. But it's still a large percent of villagers conducted this kind of partial reallocation. That's like 37%. So that's in terms of land ownership and also land tenure. There's some progress, but it's definitely not a full privatization. But the latest policy change is to harden the use right. Again, don't worry about the ownership because that's political kind of landmine. But let's look at the farmland contract and management rights. It's like a use right. And the central government in 1995, they start to propose, let's ask individual household to actually trade their kind of contractual rights on the market. So this will create some kind of a reallocation. So we can use, like, more productive farmers can actually trade in the contractual rights, and the other people can move to cities. And there are some very interesting experiments, like in Chengdu and Chongqing. In those areas, the local government started to harden this kind of contractual rights by issuing certificates. So you have a kind of a booklet says you have a certain plot of land for like 30 years or 40 years. Then you can take this to the local trading centers. So the local government is going to set up various trading centers. The major goal is to basically facilitate land consolidation. But there are problems. I think there are inadequate trading infrastructure. In many places, local officials, local governments are not very excited about this. And there are also local abuses. Typically, local officials will take land away from farmers, then basically sell this use right to the industrial businesses. That's actually prohibited under this kind of law. So there are overall ownership, there's very little change, but in terms of use right market, it's starting to emerge in the last few years, especially after 2008. So let's get to the construction land. This is a land usually used for like businesses, industries, mostly in the urban areas. In terms of ownership, again, there's no change. There's still this kind of dual structure, state-owned and collectively owned. But the use rights market is booming since 1986, when China started auctioning off the use rights in Shenzhen. And then in the 1980s, and early 1990s, the barrier between urban and rural land was actually disappearing, because urban residents started to go to the countryside to buy land, and also businesses will also use land in the countryside. But in 1998, the government started to introduce the land management law, revised the land management law. And this new law really reorganized the institution dramatically. Part of the reason is the farmland protection, because at the time, I believe Brown published a book that Who's Going to Feed China? And the Chinese government actually paid attention to this. And they also looked at the farmland, and it declined very dramatically. Then they introduced under this 1998 new revised land management law. They introduced a very complicated system. It's very much like going to the old days. The old construction land quotas will be decided by the central government. The central government is going to send down this kind of quotas to each layer of the local governments. And they have the quotas for construction land and also quotas for farmland. How much farmland you can convert to the construction land. So it's very elaborate and like a 10-year kind of plan, and also every year there will be implementation kind of policies. So, of course, it's a very, very interesting kind of a reversal, but I would like to, since I don't have a lot of time, I will focus on three issues. I think under this kind of new kind of regulatory regime, it's still problematic. One thing is administrative effectiveness versus land use efficiency. It's true, the government used this kind of top-down quota system to control the amount of land for kind of industrial business development. But there's also a problem. Whenever you have government planning, then how do you allocate a quota? And in most cases, it's decided by almost like equity. It's like we know that more developed areas should have more quota. But the problem is if I give all quota to Zhejiang, Guangdong, then other places would say, like in Shanxi or Gansu would say, not, that's not fair because we want to also develop. So that's why bureaucratically it's very easy, simple to say we'll have some equal distribution. Of course, not totally equal, but still there's a mismatch between development needs and the quotas. And this actually triggered a very interesting market. It's called a development rights market because now all provinces have to face same kind of a quota. So the rich, more developed areas start to say, oh, why can't we trade some quota with like Heilongjiang or Xinjiang? In fact, this in the late 1990s, early 2000s, Guangdong initiated this project, and Zhejiang also followed very quickly. They started to say, "Oh, we don't have these quotas, but Heilongjiang, you just cannot use up all your quotas. So I will use your construction quota and give you this kind of my kind of responsibility for farmland protection to you." So this trade actually created a lot of interesting kind of efficiency gains. It should be a win-win-win scenario for the central government and trading in and trade out kind of regions because each one can get more development opportunities. But the problem is that the central government are concerned about the quality and of this trade, and they banned this around 2006, 2007. So that's one attempt to break down this kind of control, but in the end, the central government controlled tightly. The second issue is a rigid urban-rural divide and development rights for farmers. Because we all know if land is used for industry businesses, it can create tremendous land rents. But the problem for Chinese farmers is that they're not allowed to bring their surplus land to the market because there's a major divide here. Only local governments can control this land requisition. But this caused a lot of tremendous of waste of resources. A lot of farmers just cannot use their kind of residential land quotas effectively. So this is a survey we conducted. And you can see many households do actually have second residential plots. Nationally, it's about 10% of them. And in fact, more importantly, is that many of those plots, residential kind of plots, were unused because most of these migrants worked in the cities, so they don't need that kind of land. But they cannot sell this land directly because it's banned. So that's one thing. It's clearly this kind of divide, urban-rural divide, created inefficiency. And local governments started to tap into this. They saw, oh, great, they have this kind of quota. So why don't we use this quota? So in the last few years, Tianjin started to implement this kind of rural residential land for urban apartments. Basically says, we are going to move you guys, farmers, to the cities. I will move you into the apartments. Then we will have that kind of quotas. The rural residential land, because that's technically it's construction land. Then we will use that for business development. So they actually going to tap into the farmers' development rights and benefit from this. And Chengdu, Chongqing come up with this urban-rural integration, but it's similar, very similar kind of. Basically, it's local governments grab farmers' land and then benefit from this. But these are formal bans, but there are also informal marketization. A lot of villagers start to say, well, that's not fair. We want to benefit from this land rents. So like Nanhai in Guangdong, Kunshan in Jiangsu, and Zhengezhuang in Beijing, in each cases, local villagers will say, we will just rent our land directly to the businesses, or we are going to build an apartment, sell it directly on the market. These are illegal. Very clear, illegal. But they decided to fight it out. And so far, they are actually successful. But of course, they are not supported by the central government. And finally, this is also another issue I want to talk a little bit about, is the local government's role. I think the overzealous government has created a lot of market distortions in the market space. Part of the reason is that local governments need revenue. So that land lease fees has skyrocketed in the last 10 years. And this is, of course, some data. In terms of share in the tax revenue, it's also increasing. And as a share of local budgetary revenue, it's also actually pretty high. It's 40% in the last few years. And, of course, so revenue is very important, so that's why they want to control land requisition and also sell them on the market. But this creates some problem. One is that they have incentive to keep the price high, and that way they can keep raking revenues. And so this is the house and the land price in the last 10 years or so. And so every time there's a slowdown in the market, price rise, then local government will jump in. And I have some data. I can talk about this later on. The local government use all kinds of administrative, economic, and political incentive to revive the real estate market. Then this is from real estate sector. There's also a problem in terms of industries, and because local governments want to attract the businesses, they undersell the land to industries, and this creates race to the bottom kind of competition. The tremendous amount of the land used for industrial parks in China. This creates a lot of overinvestment, congestion, environmental pollution, and also, of course, labor kind of a problem. And finally, it's that if you want to lease land cheaply to industries, you have to get land cheaply. And, of course, in the end, the farmers are going to bear the burden. And the compensation to farmers are very, very low. And as a result of this, it's a tremendous the amount of social resentment in society. Protests, demonstrations, violence, based on as a result of this land requisition, has skyrocketed again in the last few years. And this can cause some problem for the new administration. So these are three issues I think are fundamentally going to challenge the leadership and also the challenge the wisdom of this new generation of leaders. How to deal with this? And I think here is local governments can be a block to further marketization. But on the other hand is that they also provide the possibility to actually challenge the central kind of stagnation. So these are I would probably engage more conversations when we have Q&As on specific details on this. Thank you.
So I was a bit worried when Barry started off because the reform is dead in China line. I wasn't going to go with that, but he did give me an out with his in a small font, but he gave me an out for the private sector. So I'm going to talk about financial sector and particularly the monetary system in China and where reform's gone. And I'm going to start just by saying what they've done. So there has been progress, I think, in financial sector reform. I think it's probably one of the areas where the progress has been more important over the past decade or so. And I'll point to a few parts of that progress, and then I'll talk about where next. Certainly institutional reform in China has really improved. They've set up these financial sector regulatory bodies that have been professionalized. They've been trying very hard to meet international standards. There's been varied progress across the regulators, but certainly some of them are doing a lot better than others. But you can see that for such a short space of time, they've really moved quite fast in terms of building a regulatory infrastructure. And I think that's been very important. I think that's also been put China in a place in the international stage in terms of the international forum discussing regulatory policies, where they have quite a lot of say and insight. In the banks themselves, I mean, we went through a process where they stripped out bad loans from the banks, brought in strategic foreign investors, foreign banks to improve internal risk management practices and move to international accounting standards. And you know, part of the way they did that was hung out the sort of carrot of being listed on foreign exchanges. And that was quite a clever strategy of using foreign markets and the discipline in foreign markets to create domestic reform in China. Not unlike the way allowing FDI coming in to reform the production system. they're very good at using sort of the incentive system from the global economy as a way of changing the domestic economy. And I think that was one area in the banks where they were quite successful at doing that. Of course, as Barry said, the banks are still predominantly state-owned, or at least a large part of the banking system is still state-owned, but it's a lot more commercialized than it used to be. On markets, you've seen a big development of financial markets in China. Corporate bond markets, both the exchange-traded and interbank corporate bond market has been set up. There's a range of futures swaps, options markets, and commodities on interest rates on foreign currency. There's a fairly effective working interbank corporate bond market with NAFMI oversights created under the overview of the PBC. And equity markets have become more liquid. They've dealt with some of the non-tradable shares issues. Now, I'm not saying that these things have completely solved all the problems, but I think you have to point to some progress in that area. And then on the monetary operations side, which, given my employer, that's sort of interest to us, they've built out a central bank bond market, which has been used very effectively to sterilize foreign currency intervention, established a SHIBOR reference curve, so you now have sort of reference interest rates across a range of maturities in China. They've created, as I said, the interbank market and repo markets, which allow for monetary policy operations to be undertaken, and they've got a well-functioning domestic foreign currency market. Now, I think Nick's going to talk a little bit about foreign currency, so I get it out on that. I don't have to talk so much about the currency. So that was sort of two slides where I managed to do the retrospective, but given who I work for, I'm going to spend the rest of the presentation complaining about what's not being done, because that's what we do. So there's a whole lot more to be done. And I think it's the part of the reason I think now you're seeing this tension in financial reform in China, And a real questioning domestically about where they're going next, I think the West has to take a lot of responsibility for, because, the West just blew up its financial system. And so from China, you're looking out and you're saying, well, we kind of had an idea we'd go something that looks like the US or the UK maybe, and now we're not so sure, because that looks pretty unstable, and that creates social instability, and that's very undesirable. So I think now there's a real indecision as to, okay, where are we going, and how much is going to be planned, and how much is going to be market, and obviously there's sort of different camps of reformers and non-reformers. To be honest, I'm really not sure where it's going to go next, because the progress that's been made in some sense was almost the easy progress. I think, as Barry said, that the sort of the winners and losers created from that, there weren't that many losers. Recapitalizing the banks creates a lot of winners. The government loses, population inherently loses in some sense, but that's sort of an invisible loss, and the banks win, and all the interest groups are aligned to have that happen. But I think the next stage of reforms, you're actually going to talk about very significant redistribution of resources within China from corporates, from banks, from sterilized intervention in the government, and towards households, if that's the way they go. And I think that's a much more difficult political economy story in terms of doing that reform. So I'm going to focus on six aspects of the reform of what's more to be done. And I'm going to skip over the first one, just not to repeat what Nick's going to say. So the stronger exchange rate. The only point I'd make about the stronger exchange rate is you cannot have the current exchange rate regime if you're going to do financial reform in China. You need much more monetary autonomy in order to make progress on financial reform, and the current exchange rate regime generates such a large amount of foreign currency reserve accumulation that you spend all of your time trying to sterilize that foreign currency reserve accumulation, and you don't have those policy tools to be used domestically to move ahead with financial reform and to counter the effects that financial reform will give you. And I'll talk a little bit more carefully about what that means. So we really see the exchange rate, in particular an appreciation of the exchange rate, as a precondition for moving ahead with a lot of these other areas of financial reform. So that's already, when we debate in my team as to how do we think about sequencing of financial reform, and then we say, well, really, you've got to do the exchange rate first, and everybody's like, no, don't say that, because then the whole rest of the agenda is never going to get done. But I think, to be honest, if we're going to be honest and try and be pragmatic about this, I think you've got to take some of the heat out of the liquidity being injected into the economy every year through foreign currency intervention, and the way you do that is by appreciating the currency. So let's say you manage to move the currency. Now, we know there's going to be, as you go through the process of reform, this process that they have right now of targeting quantities in China is just not going to work anymore. All those quantities are going to become very unstable. So you can think of a money-demand function in China is going to be very unstable. So which are the right quantities to target? And you can see in China, this is a picture of interest rates and inflation. They do not use interest rates as a monetary policy tool. That is not what the reserve requirements are used to sterilize the foreign currency intervention. And interest rates hardly move at all. I mean, if you think of sort of a Taylor principle type approach to monetary policy, they would fail. Why? Well, because they focus on quantities and they focus on quotas. You know, that you see that across a range of reforms in China, that quotas are really important. And credit quotas are the way monetary policy is conducted. They switch on and off the credit channel as they need to in order to control the macroeconomy. Now, as I said, focusing very heavily on quantities is going to become increasingly untenable as the system becomes reformed, because those quantities are going to become unstable. So what do you need? Well, you need to establish a completely different monetary policy framework. And we think that the proper monetary policy framework in China is something you couldn't go with a pure inflation targeting framework in China, for example, because it's very unrealistic. We know they have objectives on growth. We know they have broader social objectives, and they have a very strong objective on financial stability. So I think what you need is a much more eclectic monetary policy framework that targets objectives on growth, inflation, and financial stability. You become clear about those objectives, and you give the central bank the authority in order to pursue those objectives. And how do they pursue them? Well, they use a combination of monetary policy tools, and when I say that, I mean not the credit quotas, but the usual monetary policy tools, particularly of open market operations and interest rates. And they overlay those with a set of macroprudential tools in order to maintain financial stability. So I'm thinking of things like loan-to-value ratios on property. It's perfectly appropriate as part of a monetary framework where you're worried about financial stability, and you particularly are worried about a property bubble. You'd want to overlay what you do on monetary policy with other tools that would control leverage and other things in the economy. As I said, you need to have much greater reliance on indirect instruments. Perhaps the 7-day repo rate would be a good instrument to use. And in principle, you'd need at least operational autonomy for the central bank. So you set them up with the objectives, and you give them the authority to pursue those objectives without too much political interference. I'm not talking about independence of the central bank, but at least some autonomy in how they conduct operations. I skipped over the first point. Before you get to this stage, the big problem in China that I think is not fully appreciated is there's an enormous amount of liquidity sitting in the financial system, and it's all hidden because it's controlled by quantities. So you have quantity limits on credit. Interest rates do not fully reflect the amount of liquidity in the financial system. So before you go to do any of this, and before you start really using interest rates as a true monetary policy tool, you've got to find a way to absorb the liquidity, both the flow of liquidity, which is coming in from foreign currency intervention, among other things, and the huge stock of liquidity that's being accumulated in the financial system over time. If you don't do that, as soon as you move to some monetary policy framework that looks like this, you'll have a huge surge of credit into the economy, and you'll have asset bubbles and overheating and all sorts of problems. So the first thing before you move to a different monetary policy framework is to absorb the liquidity and the interest rate in the financial system. So I think that's one very important. Regulation and supervision. As I said, there's a lot of things being done on regulation and supervision, professionalizing the system. The one big problem, I think, right now is creating three regulators in principle was a good idea. They had specialization. But now you have a real problem of regulatory coordination. And you're starting to see that because the lines between the different aspects of the financial system are becoming increasingly blurred. The non-bank financial intermediation is starting to substitute for banking intermediation. You're seeing insurance companies entering into the provision of credit space. You're seeing a whole range of things like trust companies, which in principle could be either regulated by CBRC or CSRC. And so I think as the system becomes more complicated, you're going to need some regulatory coordination, and particularly you need a very – given the regulatory competition and agency, interagency competition in China, you need a very high-level regulatory oversight body, perhaps chaired by a vice premier-level person who would ensure that everybody's on the same page and there's no holes in the architecture. Like the central bank, you also need more autonomy for the regulatory agencies. They have to pursue the objectives they're given rather than political objectives. They probably need more money and more staff. They need more enforcement and resolution powers. There's a big problem of data quality and collection from the banking system, from the insurance companies. Finding out where the problems are is really hampered by the fact that the data is just not up to scratch in terms of identifying that. And there's begun a serious effort improving stress testing architecture within China over the past couple of years, and we've helped participate in that, and I think that's an area that definitely needs a lot more work, not just for the banks, but also for non-bank intermediaries. So that's one area of regulation. The second area is if you're going to move to a more market-based financial system, you're going to have to expect there's going to be some failures every now and then. So that means you really need a crisis management framework that will effectively absorb those failures. You can't just assume that every time something goes wrong, the government steps in, takes over, and solves the problem. So you need some procedures for intervention of weak institutions and forcing them to exit. You need a clear definition of what the scope of fiscal support is to contain moral hazard problems. A deposit insurance scheme, now that's an area where I think there will be progress in the next year or two. You need limits on emergency liquidity support, but at the same time you need that liquidity support to be provided automatically. So you can't have a system where if you get temporarily into liquidity problems and you go to the central bank, there's some ambiguity about whether the central bank says yes or no in providing you those liquidity. So all of this part of a crisis management framework will be needed if you're really going to marketize the system. They don't need it right now because the system's very heavily controlled and managed. Market development, as I said, there's been a lot of progress in market development, but there's a long way to go. You look at the corporate bond market, for example, there's a lot of strange things between exchange-traded and interbank bond markets. You can see, like, yield curves in the two markets actually cross, so there's a lot of arbitrage opportunities. So you need some way to increase connectivity between those markets. There's a lot of distortions. It's very difficult to list in those markets. You have to be approved by various different agencies instead of just meeting some minimum quality standards. In general, there's a real reluctance in a lot of these markets to allow for failure. You know, nobody wants to let somebody issue a bond that might not be paid in the end. Well, that's sort of good in one way, but then, you know, a market system, occasionally you're going to have corporates that will issue bonds and won't pay them back. And so you need to be able to have a system that deals with that. Insurance is another range of areas. They need exit rules. There's consolidation in the industry. There's a lot of unprofitable insurance companies that are actually quite high financial risk for the system. I'll skip over this. And then the big area is liberalizing interest rates. Now, if you talk in China, they'll say, what are you talking about? All of our interest rates, or almost all of our interest rates, are market determined. Well, that's true. There's a central bank bond market. There's an interbank market. There's repo markets. There's corporate bond markets. They're all market determined in a way. We've done some work that shows that actually you can explain 90% of the movements, for example, in the interbank bond market interest rates by a combination of whether there's an IPO going on or what the level of the deposit rate is, and the deposit rate's regulated. So as long as you regulate those two key interest rates in the market, the lending rate and the deposit rate, all of the other term structure of interest rates, all of the other markets will be heavily dependent on those regulations. So in principle, they're market determined, but in practice, the reality is that they're determined by the regulated interest rates that you determine. And you see that, for example, in the central bank paper market, the one-year central bank paper trades extremely closely to the one-year deposit rate, and it very rarely moves. So the repo market tends to move a lot more, but a lot of that's dependent on sort of short-term volatility, IPOs, things like that. So let's say you've gone through all these steps, you've put a decent monetary policy framework in place, you've appreciated the exchange rate so you're not getting this liquidity injection from foreign currency intervention, you've built out the regulatory framework so you have a reasonable oversight over the banks, and you've absorbed the liquidity that's sitting in the system, the stock of liquidity that's sitting in the system, well, then you can start liberalizing interest rates reasonably safely. If you do it before then, as I said, as you liberalize interest rates, you're going to inject all sorts of liquidity into the banking system. The banks are starting to compete with each other. They'll start competing away their margins. You'll see loan rates falling, credit extended, and you'll have a lot of problems. And this is the sort of history internationally of interest rate reform. That's what many, many countries have done as they've liberalized. They've unintentionally loosened monetary conditions and created all sorts of headaches. Now, how do you change the current interest rate system? Well, our view is that you start raising the deposit rate first. And this is not the view in China at all. They have a much different view about how to liberalize. They think the loan rates are the ones you focus on. The main reason is because we think the cost of capital in China is inherently way, way too low. So we want to push, as we liberalize, we really want to push up the whole cost of capital. And the way to do that is as you raise the deposit rates, the loan rates will become less and less binding. The bank will start competing on the margins. They'll start allocating their capital based upon risk. You won't have to use credit controls anymore to choke off credit quantities because the costs will be much higher. The corporations won't demand as much credit. And you'll achieve the two objectives of liberalizing interest rates and at the same time raising the cost of capital and preventing injection of stimulus into the financial system. But the problem is you really have to make sure that the banks don't overcompete as you do that because the real risk is you raise the deposit rates, they don't raise the loan rates, they try and build more and more market share, they compete against each other for market share rather than thinking about profitability, and then they all go bust. And you have the way you solve that is you have a very strong regulatory framework that looks at the banks very carefully, looks at their business plans, and if they start doing things like that, you say, hey, your business plan doesn't make any sense. What's going on? And as I said, as you do this, a lot of people say, well, if you do this, then, you know, what's going to happen to interest rates? And my view is that interest rates is your choice. It's a policy variable. You will choose along the path of reform what the right interest rate will be, and that's the job of monetary policy. You will choose monetary policy to calibrate interest rates correctly so as to provide the right amount of credit stimulus to the economy. And that's going to be really, really difficult because everything's going to be moving at the same time. All of the old historical relationships are not going to hold anymore, and you're going to have to choose a monetary policy to hit your growth and inflation financial stability forecasts or objectives in a real system of flux. So it's not an easy task at all. And finally, opening up the capital account. I think our view is that you do not open up the capital account until you solve the domestic financial system issues. If you do that, you're going to have a big crisis. You can make some progress along the way. You can perhaps liberalize capital outflows. You can liberalize longer-term inward flows like FDI. But particularly opening up to portfolio flows is going to be a long time and needs to be handled very carefully. And you're already starting to see this bottom picture on the capital account. You're starting to see increasing amounts of capital flows coming through the balance of payments, which is already showing you that the capital controls are in some sense becoming less effective. Now, this is not hot money in a real sense because these are flows that are being registered in the BOP and measured. So these are loan flows. So there's an allowance for these flows to come in. And that's going to continue unless you do the reforms, appreciate the currency, reform the financial system. Otherwise, you're going to have all of these inflows coming through the capital account. So that pressure is there, and that's sort of why there's an urgency to do some reform. And just finally, renminbi internationalization could be part of this process, but it's really on a separate track. It's a very different process from the domestic financial liberalization and opening up the capital account. Okay, so I'm going to finish there.
I'm going to talk more on one aspect of the financial sector, that is the exchange rate, but I want to begin by a few general remarks. I do agree with Barry that major economic reforms have not occurred outside the financial sector since 2002, but nonetheless, economic growth has been very strong, and I would not, I would attribute this primarily to the reforms initiated in the previous regime, prior to the Hu-Wen regime. And I think, in particular, the private sector has continued to do very, very well since 2002. It has continuously expanded its share of manufacturing output. It has become now the most important source of growth of exports. Back in 1995, state-owned firms accounted for about two-thirds of China's exports. This has now fallen to about 14%. Earlier, foreign firms picked up most of the slack, but since 2005, private firms have more than doubled their share of China's exports, and they're now the largest source of the growth of China's exports. So I think the dynamism of the private sector that we've seen reflects momentum from reforms carried out prior to the Hu Jintao-Wen Jiabao era. I think more generally in terms of economic reform, looking at China's macro policy, which is what I was asked to do, I would say that the period since 2002 has been marked by the emergence of very large imbalances that the regime will have to address over time. It's indicated it will do that in the 12 five-year plan, but I think the macro policy failures of the last 10 years are really quite substantial in the foreign exchange area in particular. And what I want to talk about, and some of you have seen these diagrams before, this is looking at what's happening to the real exchange rate. Before Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao came to power, the exchange rate was appreciating at about 5% per year on average. And since that time, there's been very, very little appreciation, about 0.5% per year. So they've held the exchange rate very constant, the average rate of appreciation being roughly about a tenth of what it was in the earlier period. And the result is fairly predictable. China had a fairly modest external surplus as measured by the current account in the first period, something a little over 2% of GDP. But in the more recent period, in the Hu-Wen era, the external surplus has exploded, reaching a high of 10% in 2007 and has averaged about 7% for the period as a whole. Obviously, it's come down dramatically as a result of the global financial and economic crisis, but predictably, there's a relationship between the exchange rate, which I showed you earlier, and the current account, which I'm showing you on this slide. Now, in the first period, when the currency was steadily appreciating and the external surplus was fairly small, the additions to foreign exchange reserves were really quite modest, averaging something in the neighborhood of about 3% per year. And by the time you got to the end of 2002, China's total foreign exchange reserves were about $286 billion U.S. dollars. In the second period, to keep the currency from appreciating, the central bank had to intervene massively and continuously in the foreign exchange market. Intervention averaged about 10% of GDP in this period, and reserves by the end of the year 2010, as we all know, reached about $2.85 trillion, curiously just 10 times what they were at the end of 2002. This created a central conflict for People's Bank of China, how to maintain price stability, their traditional mandate, and how to also maintain an undervalued exchange rate. The reserve buildup meant a massive increase in the domestic money supply, which they had to sterilize, which they did quite effectively through a couple of different mechanisms. First of all, they created central bank bills, which they started to sell in very large quantities in the second period. And by the end of 2010, central bank bills outstanding were in the neighborhood of about 4 trillion RMB. For the period as a whole, the bills outstanding averaged about 10% of GDP. So they sold the bills to the banks to get the money out of circulation that had been injected when they purchased the foreign exchange reserves. Secondly, they dramatically increased the required reserve ratio, the share of deposits that banks must deposit in the central bank. As you can see, in the earlier period when the currency was not undervalued, there was little buildup of foreign exchange reserves. The required reserve ratio was in the neighborhood of 7 or 8%. Most of the time it was around 6%, which is a not unusual ratio for a well-functioning, I would say, financial system. In the second period, you see a very dramatic increase over time, the required reserve ratio averaging about 12.5% and currently standing at 21% for the large financial institutions, a very, very elevated required reserve ratio. Now, normally, sterilization on this scale for this many years would become increasingly expensive for any central bank. They'd have to pay higher and higher interest rates over time to get investors to hold larger quantities of their sterilization instruments, the central bank bills in particular. But China avoided this. China's central bank avoided this, short-circuited this problem by forcing state-owned banks to buy bonds at extremely low interest rates. And more importantly, they relied, as Nigel's already said, primarily on raising the required reserve ratio as the mechanism for sterilizing the increases in the money supply. And they paid very, very low rates of interest on those required reserves, something in the neighborhood of about 1.6%. So what happened was that this massive sterilization program, which you can see is a big chunk of GDP, implicitly imposed a very large tax on the banking system. They had to put a lot of their deposits that they had collected into assets that had very, very low yields. Now, the central bank, of course, actually made it up to them by putting a ceiling on deposit rates. They had established these ceiling deposit rates all along, but in the period up through about 2003, before the currency became significantly undervalued, before the buildup of foreign exchange reserves became so large, before sterilization became so massive, these rates were set so that the real rate of interest, for example, I show you here on one-year deposit, was positive. It was 3.0%. In other words, if you put your money in the bank, you were going to get, on average, 3% real return after inflation. And if you look closely at the diagram, you can see that the real return was in positive territory every single month up through until November and December 2003, when it went negative for the first time. Now, in the more recent period, the rates have been adjusted by the central bank in such a way that the average return to deposit holders has been quite negative, about minus 0.4. So very substantial difference between the first period when returns to savings were positive and the more recent period when the currency has been undervalued, when returns to savings in bank deposits have been negative. So, in effect, the banks were subsidized through cheap deposits, which allowed them to earn very high rates of return, even though they had a very large share of their assets tied up in low-yielding reserves at the central bank. Now, what was the consequence of this, I would characterize as a major distortion in the financial system? Well, a couple of things are quite important. First of all, households began to save quite a bit more as the return on their financial savings declined. You can see, and these are the data from the flow of funds, in the first period through 2003, the average rate of saving from after-tax income was about 30%, and on average in the subsequent years, it's substantially higher, something in excess of 36%. Unfortunately, these flow of funds data come out with quite a lag, so we're not quite sure what's happened to the savings rate in more recent years, but soon I hope we'll have data for 2009. So the first consequence from the point of view of the household sector is that households began to save a much higher share of their after-tax income, and that, in turn, contributed to one of the major imbalances that's evident in the Chinese economy, and that is its relatively low consumption share in GDP. This happened really for two reasons directly related to financial repression. First of all, when the interest rate went down in real terms, the household earnings from savings were depressed, so household income growth was way below what it would have been if earlier policies had been sustained. And secondly, households saved more from the smaller disposable income that they had. And that's a very large part of this imbalance that emerged in terms of the very low consumption share in GDP. Now, the other thing that households did was to step up their investment in residential property. In the first period, if you look at what was going on, the returns to property were actually less than the returns to financial assets because property price appreciation was very modest. But in the last six, seven, 8 years, when the real returns to financial assets have been negative, the real return to property has been quite high. And as you can see, the share of investment in residential property relative to GDP roughly doubled between the two periods, and we're now at an all-time high of about 9.1%. I won't go into the details, but really urbanization does not explain this growth in investment in residential property. The pace of urbanization since 2003 has actually been slower than it was in the earlier period. So I would say inadvertently the government has made housing a preferred asset class. Other things have contributed to this, the lack of capital account convertibility, people can't put their money offshore, a relatively weak governance of the Shanghai Stock Exchange has resulted in a high degree of volatility in that market, so that households have basically been fleeing from the equity market for quite some time. Now, if you want to look at this in comparative perspective, which I think is useful, here we are today in China in the first half of this year investing a little over 9% of GDP in property. At the peak in Taiwan was in 1980 at about 4%. India is now up to about 5.2%. So China is investing substantially more in residential property, substantially more than any other emerging market that I can find data for. And you can see what's happening in terms of the composition of urban household wealth. The share that was in bank deposits used to be relatively high, about 70%, but has fallen quite dramatically. The share in property has more than doubled, and now stands at about 40%. So the question one has to ask, given the fact the reality has been that residential property has become the biggest driver of economic growth in China in recent years, is this sustainable? My answer is I think it's certainly questionable. It seems unlikely that households are going to want to double the share of their assets in residential property again. They're already up to 40%. Another thing to keep in mind is that household debt as a share of disposable income has increased dramatically over the past 2 years. It's gone from about 30% to 50%, and the level of household debt in China is now much higher than any emerging market that I can find data for. You look at Indonesia, for example, which is at not too far from China in terms of per capita GDP. Household debt as a share of disposable income is something in the neighborhood of about 10%. You can look at similar numbers for Philippines and a range of other countries. The level of debt in China is relatively high. So a second reason for thinking that the boom in housing is not sustainable is that households may not be willing to incur additional debt relative to their disposable income. A third factor could be rising interest rates, not in the short term but over the medium term. All the mortgages in China are floating rate mortgages, so if interest rates go up, the cost of investing in residential property goes up. We could have improved governance of the Shanghai Stock Exchange, which would make equities a more viable long-term asset class that might cause people to shift more of their wealth into equities. Or if China follows through on its announced plan to further liberalize the capital account, it might become increasingly possible for domestic residents to invest abroad. And again, that could erode the preferred asset class that the property sector has enjoyed in recent years. So I think in conclusion, I would say China has an excellent record of liberalizing the prices of almost all goods and services in the first couple of decades of economic reform, but has continued to intervene massively over the last decade in the foreign exchange market to hold down the value of the RMB. And I would say in an economy in which trade looms so large as it does in China, this is a really very massive distortion that has a very significant impact on the allocation of resources. It has heightened the profitability of production in the tradable goods sector and thus led to a very sharp increase in the share of investment flowing into the manufacturing sector since 2002 and the reemergence of a super elevated share of manufacturing in GDP. China has the highest share of manufacturing in GDP of any country in the world, and I don't think it's an accident. It's gone up significantly since 2002. It has this distortion has depressed profitability in the services sector and led to a sharp drop in the share of investment flowing into the services sector since 2002. And as a result, we have seen stagnation basically in the services share of GDP since 2002. Which follows a period of the 1980s and 90s in which the services share of GDP roughly doubled from 20% to 40%. This distortion has also, I believe, led to financial repression as reflected in the negative deposit rates, which have been a major contributor, as I've already indicated, to a fall in the consumption share of GDP through the two channels that I mentioned. Lower real deposit rates mean lower income, and lower real deposit rates have meant higher savings. As a share of disposable income, both contributing to a shrinkage of consumption relative to GDP. And finally, financial repression has caused households to perceive housing as a preferred asset class, led to a massive increase in investment in housing that I say looks to be unsustainable over the medium term. So I would think that China should be thinking about the lesson of the United States and advanced industrial countries over the past few years, and I think the lesson is simple. Financial distortions lead to accumulation of asset positions that ultimately prove to be not sustainable and are very difficult to unwind, except potentially at a very high cost. Thank you. So I'm not a fan of the macro policy of the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao period.
Thank you very much. While the speakers are coming up and getting mic'd up, I guess you aren't going to get mic'd up. You have microphones here. But while they're sitting down, let me see if I can summarize in four big points that I took away from these remarks. And speakers are, of course, more than welcome to say I've distorted what they said. But my four big takeaways within this very rich array of details are, one, that the major reforms of the 1990s are still paying off, and especially in the dynamism of the private sector, which has really continued to take advantage of some of the openings that those reforms created. Secondly, that there has been little by way of market reform since 2002. The Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao administration clearly has not gone in that direction. Thirdly, at least outside of the financial sector and even within the financial sector, I was impressed on balance with how limited the reforms have been. Thirdly, that in fact this administration has moved toward ever-growing government role in the economy, and that is in part responsible for major imbalances that have become more difficult. And finally, therefore, that the new leaders coming in 2012, 2013 are going to have one hell of an inbox to deal with, and really major reforms that they're going to have to undertake, because the costs of not doing more in the last 10 years, somewhat ironic, because it's during the last 10 years that the rest of the world has sat back and said, holy cow, look at what the Chinese are doing. You know, just nothing but success from beginning to end. And the story that at least I took away from this is, well, that's actually the playing out of very tough decisions made in the Jiang Zemin Zhu Rongji administration, made and implemented, and seeing the benefits of those. Those benefits are now, though, tipping over into a very serious set of problems that require a new set of very tough reforms, and that's going to be the agenda for the next leadership. I hope I haven't distorted that in a way that makes you terribly uncomfortable. I don't see sweat on any brow here. So, okay. With that, let me open the floor to questions. As usual, we have roving mics. We'll ask that you give your name and your affiliation, and then if you wish to direct a question to one speaker, feel free. Otherwise, anyone can take it up. Please, back here. Yes.
Akira Chiba, Japanese Embassy. This is great. I'm glad I came. I have a number of questions, but I limit to just one. And I have a question for Professor Su. A joint venture in China works out this way. It's usually that the Chinese side contributes with land, and the Japanese side, in my case, contributes with everything else. And somehow the price tag on the land manages to be 51% of the share, so the China's a majority. The problem is, this piece of land had no price tag until the day before because it was collectively owned and the uses cannot be transferred. So once it re-registers as state property, it suddenly manages to be 51% of any investment. My question is, how does this, is there any way to find out this, how this alchemy contributes to the seeming growth of China?
Well, that's a tough question. I think one, I would like to ask, actually, because the four collectives own the land, they cannot go to the on the market directly. It's all private. And in many cases, we went to like South China, Guangdong, Fujian areas. It's like I would just give this part of land to the, you will run, you basically run, you will give the rent to me. So it's not like a stock, joint stock companies. I think you are talking about is really state-owned land. Like if you go to Kunshan, it's like Kunshan, the industrial park. Of course, the land owned by the local government, they're going to say, let's have a joint venture. And this is I will value this at a certain, and so it's about 51%, so we will control the businesses. I think it's definitely a problem. That's why the most active land market, especially in Guangdong and Fujian, many areas, is really collective owned land. Because you're thinking about the gigantic, like international, firms, of course they will have to go to the state. But when I talked is this, small private firms or foreign firms will come mostly first to the collective, kind of villages or townships. Because usually they have very flexible kind of arrangement. Because for state is really like, I'm going to lease this for 40 years. And you have to pay the lease lump sum, like in 1 year or half year. But for collective communities, it's like you will pay annual rent. Every year is $6,000. And so it's very flexible, and the local government officials are not involved in the management of those enterprises. So in a way, I think there are two tracks here. And I think what you are talking about is really state. Local government are really managing this land, and they treat this as their assets. I don't know if it's answered.
I'm sorry, but that was exactly my question, and I wanted to know how this $0 to suddenly 100 million yen piece of land that definitely has to contribute to the growth, the seeming growth of China. So I'd like to know the proportion of the new price tag.
It's just accounting, like all of a sudden.
Yeah, frankly, I'm not sure what you mean by that. It sounds like Fubing is not either. You mean in determining, in fixing a price for the land, that somehow is reflected in the GDP of China? So how much of GDP growth is in reality arbitrary pricing of land?
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying? Oh, I don't. Does anyone have a capacity to respond to that? Hearing no responses, I think, is a good question, but not one that we're going to resolve right now. Okay. Thank you. Eric?
Eric McVeigh in the Institute of Foreign Policy Analysis. I think I'm sort of following up on your fourth takeaway point, and maybe directed at Barry and Nick. What do you make of the Richburg article the other day in the Post on the Wenzhou debt? And I think it mentioned Neymongu, Inner Mongolia as well. Overwhelming debt made it sound like maybe things were going to become apart at the seams. Is that demanding reforms? And I guess I wonder the effect that I've heard from some of my Chinese interlocutors. They seem to think that China had weathered the economic crisis so much better than the rest of the world, and maybe a bit of hubris there. Does that diminish that for them?
Mother, please be quite close to your microphone.
Yeah, I mean, the background on this is that credit has really tightened quite a bit in China from the formal banking system. If you look at the absolute numbers, it seems like the growth rate of credit is fairly high, but you have to keep in mind that we're in a period now where the GDP deflator is running at 8% per year. So if you look at the growth of credit in real terms today, it's only about 7 or 8%. And in 2009, it was 32%. In 2010, it was 13%. So we're looking at the growth of credit from the formal banking system that has come down very dramatically as the authorities have tried to bring inflation under control. And so, as Nigel mentioned, you see now a growth of credit through a variety of the informal mechanisms, the underground banking system, the private banking in Wenzhou, and so forth. So you did see a lot of growth of credit in some of those areas. It's very unclear how big this market is. The size of it is varying. You know, the estimates vary by a factor of about 10 to 1. But Wenzhou's always been famous for having underground banking. So I don't think the problem in Wenzhou is as large as Keith's article and several other articles, I think, have overestimated. They talk about 80 companies that have gone bankrupt, you know, but there's something like 400,000 companies in Wenzhou, and, you know, 10,000 new ones are springing up every year. So there's always a lot of churn. So I think it's been a little overinterpreted.
I wonder whether I could expand on that with two follow-on questions. One is, nationwide, how serious is the problem of local government debt? Given potential fall in land values and the kind of ricochet effects of that? And then secondly is the implication of what we've been seeing with the phasing out of the stimulus program and therefore underlying debt issues becoming more prominent. Is the implication that at some point they're going to have to go back and somehow or other restructure the 1994 tax reform in order to allocate more tax revenue to localities and less to the central government? Because clearly there's a misallocation here, at least in my view, with the center getting the overwhelming majority of revenues, but the overwhelming majority of budgetary expenditures are at local levels. For anyone?
On the tax reform, I imagine it's such a complicated political economic problem that I would see them much more likely to take a very ad hoc approach in terms of intergovernment transfers to solve whatever mm-hmm. problems might be residual from the local government debt issue. In some sense, they're already doing that to some extent, allowing local governments to issue bonds, but sponsored by the Ministry of Finance, and then presumably those bonds will be repaid from the revenue sharing of the provinces sometime in the future. So I think you're going to have, rather than seeing some big systematic reform of intergovernment relations, I would see much more likely to be quite ad hoc and actually maybe even non-transparent, as to what's really going on beneath the surface. Local government debt problem, I think it's certainly a problem. I mean, I think one of the questions, that this hubris from successfully having escaped the global financial crisis, I don't see that so much in China. I think people are underestimating. China paid a cost from the global financial crisis. That cost is not immediate. It's not as visible as perhaps you saw in the U.S. or Europe, but they paid a pretty significant cost. They're going to have to work off the credit that they provided to the financial system over a number of years. Local governments is one part of that. I'm sort of reassured that they're already quite quietly restructuring that debt. They're requiring the banks to return to local governments, asking them to cough up more collateral, more land, more money, more shares of state enterprises in order to back that debt. Ultimately, a lot of that debt's at zero or negative real interest rates. And as long as the tax base is growing as fast as it is growing, and the tax base is growing very fast, then, you know, over time that debt sort of appears. Maybe it'll be evergreen, stretched out. There'll be probably some messy, visible problems where they'll have to resolve certain municipalities or provinces where they won't be able to generate enough resources to repay the debt. But I'm sort of skeptical that it's a huge systemic problem waiting to. I think the bigger systemic problem, which I think somebody had discussed earlier, was this growth of the non-bank channels. And I think the Wenzhou is really a sideshow. It really distracts attention. The bulk of this is not the sort of curb lending, you know, shadowy figures, exciting stories of entrepreneurs fleeing Wenzhou for their lives. It's into corporate lending, it's lending from non-bank financial intermediaries, it's trusts, it's lending coming through the balance of payments from offshore entities. The volumes coming there are so much larger than this other stuff.
Thank you very much. Yeah, both, I guess, Barry and then Nick, please.
I want to slightly disagree with both my esteemed colleagues. I mean, I agree in a way what's happening in Wenzhou is a kind of a sideshow. It's a very distinctive region in China economically, certainly. But all of the problems that are exploding there are sort of concentrated manifestations of exactly the kind of things that we're talking about. And the links of credit that are breaking down in Wenzhou, I think, are exactly not shadowy figures hanging out on the street corner. They're complex webs of lending that involve state banks, trust companies, supplier companies that provide credit back and forth. And as credit is tightened in the way that Nick is describing, because credit finally is getting to be tight in a way that I think overall is a good thing, the irrationalities of the system and the preferences given to state priority investment projects are pushing the credit constraints onto the private sector. And I think it's an important phenomenon. It doesn't necessarily mean the system's on the brink of collapse, but it's not just a sideshow, I don't think.
Nick?
I agree with Nigel. I think the local debt problem is manageable. I think in the crisis of 2008-09, they pushed a lot of credit out to local platform companies. A lot of this infrastructure should never have been financed with short-term bank capital in the first place. I think the returns on it will be high. It'll have to be, you know, the structure of it will have to be financed or, you know, restructured and lengthened and so forth. I'm much more worried. It's about 25% of GDP. I'm much more worried about the total exposure of the banking system to the property sector than I am about their exposure to platform companies. And their exposure to if you take the sum of mortgage debt of individuals and lending to property development companies, it comes out to just over 20% of GDP. So it's slightly smaller than the local platform company borrowing, but I think it's a much bigger risk to the system.
Okay. Yes, back here.
Stella Dawson at Reuters. Given that you are seeing a slowdown, if not an actual retrenchment, in the pace of reforms in the last decade, how do you see that's going to affect U.S.-China relations in coming years? And in particular, where U.S. corporations are starting to grow frustrated with their more limited access to the Chinese market that they had seen before. What pressures do you see corporations bringing to bear on the administration to change the tone and the tenor of its relationship with China?
Who are you directing it toward?
Maybe I should start because, as an outsider, I know less about the Washington, D.C. than any of my esteemed colleagues here. I think the most important effect is that it it undermines the strength of a strong pro-China business lobbying group. And so there's less effective advocacy of close ties. Of course, at the same time, the Chinese economy is now twice as big as what it was 10 years ago, more than twice as big. And so we adapt, even though we're frustrated.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Hi, Jason Froelich, U.S. Asia Institute. This has been hinted at by things that's been said before today, but I wanted to be, get more specific. The real estate where people keep buying real estate and it keeps being sold at higher prices sounds a lot like what happened to the U.S. a few years ago. So what I wanted to know is, what is the risk of something similar to what happened to the U.S. happening to China, with a real estate bubble causing a massive amount of financial turmoil in China?
In answering, please note the difference in leverage and kind of how that affects the answer.
Well, I think there's a risk accumulating in overinvestment in the residential property sector. It's not the same kind of risk we had in the U.S. because the indebtedness of the household sector is far, far less. Remember, at the peak, just before things went south, shall we say, the average household in the United States had debt equal to 132% of their annual disposable income. So China's jumped up a lot in the last couple of years, but it's still only at 50%, and the banks have required very large down payments for investments in non-owner-occupied housing, something that we would have been wise to have done starting about a decade ago. So the financial risks, direct financial risks, are somewhat smaller. But I would say the macroeconomic risk is much bigger, because the share of investment going to residential property is so large. Remember, in the U.S., the long-term rate of investment in residential property as a share of GDP is 4%. And in the peak, in 2005, we went up to 6%. So we had a fairly modest increase in the share of investment going to residential property. But we had lots of leverage. China's had a massive increase in the amount of investment with much more modest leverage. So if there's a correction, I'm kind of worried what I call a macro risk. I mean, 40% of the steel that's produced in China goes into residential property construction. Similarly, large shares of cement and aluminum and copper and a whole range of other commodities are going into residential property. That's why I say residential property has been the biggest driver of economic growth over the last 5 or 6 years. So if you have a big correction in the property sector, the exposure of the financial sector is not just going to be whether or not individuals pay their mortgage loans, but whether a huge swath of the economy can continue to be profitable and service their debt. So in the end, if you have a big enough correction, you will have a substantial effect on the financial sector as well. But the mechanisms and the linkages, I think, would look somewhat different than in the U.S.
Yes, Becker.
Hi, Stephanie Sheridan with IPAI Global. I had a question kind of touching on this gentleman's question with regard to the increase in GDP in China over the last number of years and the influence that that has had with regard to financing products that were part of the financial crisis in the U.S. in terms of financial flows coming in from China to the U.S. and then seeing that now we have a concentrated financing in the housing sector in China as well. Is there any conversation going on about how to develop equal types of mechanisms to support other types of growth outside of the housing sector, or things like these in terms of tool development for economies such as China that are growing rapidly, and then how to channel that funding in other ways besides just the housing sector? And I see China as a pivotal role in this because of its GDP growth projected into the future. Thank you.
I would just say I think the problem is on the demand side, not the supply side. I mean, there's a tremendous demand for financing on the part of property developers and residential mortgage borrowers, because that's where they think the high returns are. And if you get rid of the underlying distortions, I think the credit is going to flow elsewhere. But it's going to be a long, complicated process, as Nigel said, because basically real lending rates are far too low. And so the demand for credit is very high. But I think this concentrated flow of credit into the housing sector is a function of the demand side, not limitations on, you know, where the funds can flow.
Let me just add one thing, is that the Chinese government has been trying very hard to find other growth points. I think Nick mentioned, it's the reason is that they distorted the market. That's why this sector is growing stronger and stronger. And in fact, as a result of all this kind of state marching and its private retreating in the last few years, the service sector, especially service industries, it can be a tremendous sector to absorb the labor and also create a lot of new kind of services and technologies. But unfortunately, so in those areas, state is very strong and basically keep the state monopoly, and they just don't want the private sectors to enter those businesses. So that's, in a way, it's kind of also a political story behind this.
Yes, sir, back.
Ted Truman from the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I'd like to come back to Ken's, I guess, your fourth point about the size of the inbox and whether – I was wondering whether that is indeed what panelists mean, in the sense that it is an inbox that is – there are inboxes which have to be addressed over some period of time, and they will be addressed, right? We all have big inboxes. Or these are inboxes which all of which things are marked urgent. And in the second case, then if it's the latter rather than the former, then you're asking, I guess the question really is, will this that inbox be quickly addressed, and what are the consequences if it's not?
Let me add to that by a little bit of a reframing, and this may give an opportunity for everyone to sum up with final comments they want to make, because we're almost out of time. And that is, if the new leadership comes in and for whatever reason, structural, political, personality, or whatever, does not make decisions that come at the cost of major interests in order to promote what they regard as necessary reforms, if on balance they can't seem to get that done, what are the implications of that? I mean, how much trouble is China in? What kind of trouble, and how quickly? Start at that. Okay. Nigel, please.
My heart sank when Nick pointed this way. Let's take financial reform. I think financial reform will happen in China. It's a question of whether it was going to happen in a planned, concerted, stable way, or if the market's going to do it. And you're seeing the market already doing it. You're seeing the non-bank channels building. You're seeing flows becoming increasingly porous to the capital controls. You're seeing people finding ways to get better rate of return in property, in other assets. The problem with allowing the market to do it, that's going to be pretty volatile. So I think that is a real important area where the new administration should move forward, because the time's ticking already, and if they don't decide to do it, it's going to happen anyway, I think, in one way or the other.
Thank you. Fubin?
I think one serious consequences of inaction is this, the local government's over-interventionist. I think this is going to cause, first in the real estate sector, I agree, this is probably not financially, it's not that dire, but from political perspective, local government have strong incentive to keep this kind of market high. And so that, I think it's a really issue. And on the other side is industrial development and overbuilding in manufacturing capacity. I think this is two sides of the coin, same coin, because of land developmentalism. I think the central government must address this issue. Again, going back to Ken's point, central-local fiscal relations. This is a really fundamentally it's because local governments are short of revenue, so they just is desperate to come up with any kind of money. So that can keep make a lot of problems. And I think it's not just real estate sector, but also about the overall industrial development in China.
Thank you.
I think it's clear that the inbox is building up. We, you know, basically since 2004, we see this very gradual buildup of problems that we can see both on the macro policy side, as Nick elucidated so well, and on the institutional side. So there is, you know, I mean, it's funny. If we had held this panel, say, 10 years ago, I think you would have found that the economists were the most optimistic people about China. You know, they really were very approving of what had been accomplished in the 1990s. But it's striking how pessimistic everybody was today. So there's been a clear reversal. And I think that reflects the buildup of pressures that will almost certainly be deferred until after the new leadership takes power. I think they can get away with deferring them for a year or two. But after that, it's very difficult for me to envision a future that doesn't involve kind of partial economic crises compelling shifts in policy stance.
Well, I think one has to look at, you know, the domestic political economy. Some of these things have been on the agenda for a long time. Liberalization of interest rates, for example. Wen Jiabao talked about it very explicitly in 2009 at the NPC. I think it was explicitly also in the 11th five-year plan. But they never really got any traction, and nothing happened, and the vested interests against liberalizing are very, very strong. It's basically, you know, any form of financial repression is a massive redistribution scheme, and the people that are benefiting, most notably the banks and the central bank, are not going to be able to agree to any rapid interest rate liberalization. And in any case, as Nigel pointed out so well, you can't really go in that direction until you've got your exchange rate nearer to some equilibrium level, and you have a massive, overbloated tradable goods sector that is fighting tooth and nail to keep the exchange rate from appreciating by more than a couple percentage points per year. And I don't know, so you can get very pessimistic. On the other hand, in the past, when it's been clear that they've got to do things in order to sustain economic growth, it's gotten done. So I'd bet eventually it'll get done. It'll be messy. It'll be late. But they'll have to move ahead. If they don't, they'll have to be willing to live with much, much lower growth.
We gave the panel members an extraordinarily difficult task in trying to sum up the Hu Jintao Wen Jiabao administration across a series of issues and do it both with a broad framework and with some details on particular sectors. And I hope you all will join me in thanking them for an extraordinary job in doing this. Thank you very much.